Good morning. This is Director Olenek. Before we begin the agenda, I want to go over a few items. This meeting is being recorded and the audio will be available on the PERV's website relatively quickly. As always, we're using a hybrid meeting, so we will have people who will be presenting online versus in person. As well, Board Member Jaramillo is attending virtually. A few other items to note. As always, public testimony will be taken on action items at the Chair's discretion. The Chair did not receive any requests to present oral testimony on any agenda items at today's meeting. With that, I will turn the meeting over to Chair Shenoy.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the February 2023 Oregon Board meeting. I'm Sadhana Shenoy, Chair of the Board. Call this meeting to order. Happy New Year, everyone. I'll turn it over to Kevin for the directors.
Meeting minutes first.
First up on the agenda is the approval of the December 2022 board meeting minutes. Any questions, comments from the board on the minutes as presented?
This is Stephen Buckley. I have one minor suggested change to section A4. This is discussing the board scorecard report, and on the third line, there's reference to the next report being presented on June 2, 2022. I think we want to change the year to 2023.
Thank you.
With that correction or edit, I would move approval for this. Lawrence Fretzel.
Stephen Buckley, I second the motion.
Thank you. All in favor? Please say aye. Sadhana Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fretzel, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Jardon Jaramillo, aye.
Thank you all. The December board meeting minutes are approved with the one change suggested. And now, Kevin's report.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, Vice Chair Fernstall, board members. For the record, Kevin Olenek, Director. Welcome to the February 23rd board meeting. For board members, a quick reminder to please identify yourself when speaking, moving, or seconding a motion so we can reflect that accurately in the minutes. And board members or presenters, please put on your camera when speaking. As always, we have an interesting agenda to work through this morning. With respect to the director's report itself, this is usually a summary of items the board should be aware of and aren't part of the board agenda materials. In my report, one thing to note, I did talk about the death calculation processing and misstated that the work was done in the death calculations unit. Actually, the calculations section performs the calculation and distribution of the death benefit, and then the specialty qualifications unit identifies the beneficiaries, processes the forms, eligibility, et cetera. So I want to make sure I give credit where credit is due. Not included in the report and not covered by an agenda item is a Senate Bill 1049 update. With respect to member redirect, we're still in the process of rebaselining the schedule for what should be the final time, as we've now finalized the remaining member redirect work streams, due in large part to the complexity of the remaining work packages. Technical debt, no, doing some fine tuning to the schedule there, but no impact to scope or budget. And the cross-project work, we've made considerable progress on that work package, the IAP rebalancing tool. And currently UAT for our March 23rd implementation for member redirect is going very well. I think we're at 93% tested and 92% passed on our UAT. One other item to note is additionally, Governor Kotek unveiled her governor's recommended budget this past Tuesday. From an overall perspective, PERS has a majority of our policy packages included in this, in large part due to being an other funds agency as compared to a general fund agency. I am disappointed to advise the board that our enterprise risk management policy package was not included, and there was a reduction in our Senate Bill 1049 ask that I'm hoping we can resolve through the budgetary process. One thing to note on the forward-looking calendar is that the joint OIC PERS meeting is scheduled for May 31st at the OIC meeting. Investment report I won't touch because we're going to be talking about the preliminary earnings and crediting on item C4. Budget execution report, we are still staying around the 5% underspend at this point in time and don't see that changing much, if at all, through the remainder of the biennia. Jason will present the annual report of director's financial transactions and have the minutes reflect receipt of that report. From an administrative rulemaking perspective, Stephanie will notice two rules and recommend adoption of two others. Following that, Heather will provide a legislative update with a focus on the current 2023 legislative session. Then Rebecca Craven, our new modernization program director, will provide an overview of what we're doing on that. Following that, Jake Winship will provide a Senate Bill 1566 statutory reporting update. And then Richard Horsford, Matt Graves will present the preliminary 2022 earnings crediting and reserve report. Following that, we will have a couple items with our consulting actuary, Milliman. First, they'll discuss the response to the Secretary of State actuarial review report. And then we'll be presenting verbally reflections on earnings through December 31st, 2022, and what the funded status would be based on early returns. With that, if there's any questions, more than happy to respond to them.
I just want to make a comment that at the all-staff meeting in December, the agency recognized some exceptional employees for 2022. On behalf of the board, congratulations to Patricia and Jason Stallings, who shared the Employee of the Year award, and to Nick Mardello for the Manager of the Year. I had a quick question for page 16. I noticed that IAP expenses in the budget are there's a huge variance between the budget and the actual expense, and I was wondering
Certainly, Chair Shenoy. With respect to the IAP expenditures, what we are required to do when we do our budget is forecast what we believe the payments will be from both the defined benefit payment streams and the IAP. And obviously, we have to do that well in advance of when they happen. What we're seeing in this last while is the IAP payouts are higher than budgeted. Not quite sure what the reason is, but we are seeing that. We are following it closely, and if necessary, we would ask the legislature for adjustment to that payment such that we have a budget. It is something that is sort of it's a rubber stamp in the sense that we have to pay the benefits that we pay out. So there's not much there. One thing to note, though, is there are quite a few rollovers from our IAP account that go into the Oregon Savings Growth Plan. So it's something that OSGP covers to make sure that we're understanding the rollovers that go from IAP. It gives them an ability to consolidate their funds with, you know, sort of their defined contribution style funds, and gives them a bit more flexibility longer term on that front compared to what we can sometimes offer them for withdrawal and payment options. There we go. Nope, it's going to be up.
Yeah. Okay. Better? Yeah. Okay, so the next item is Jason Stanley.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, Jason Stanley, Chief Compliance Audit and Risk Officer. And I'm here for the annual report of reviewing the director's expenses for the fiscal year ended June 30th, 2022. We went over these in more detail at the last Audit and Risk Committee meeting in December. And so what I'm looking for today is acknowledge the receipt of this report. And then if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer those. This is in line with the Oregon Accounting Manual and required that we do this on an annual basis. For the year, there were no expenditures of question. Everything looked appropriate. I should also like to note that in real time, I'm reviewing Director Olenek's expenses, and his time is reviewed by Deputy Director Yvette Ellis-Rhodes every month. So we're keeping an eye on him throughout the year. but if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer those, or just looking for a motion to officially receive these, and we'll put those in the minutes.
Questions?
This is Stephen Buckley. I move that the board acknowledge receipt of the director's financial transactions for the fiscal year, which ended June 30, 2022.
John Scanlon, I second.
Thank you. Those in favor, please say aye. Sadna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
Thank you, everyone. So moved. Thank you, Jason. We move on next to the Section B, Administrative Rulemaking. Stephanie Wan.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, Stephanie Vaughn with PERS. I just want to make sure y'all can hear me okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you very much. We'll begin with item B1, which is notice of our rules regarding plan limitations. These are annual limits that we make every year, or changes that we make every year in compliance with the Social Security income limits, the IRS limits on contributions to the plan, as well as our own statutory limits for salary, annual salary limitations, and the monthly limitation or threshold for making contributions to the employee pension stability account. With regard to the changes to our statutory limits, those are made in accordance, or those are adjusted in accordance with the CPI, which as of December 2022 was 7.1%, which brings our annual salary limitation to $225,533 and the monthly threshold limit to $3,570. This is notice only, so no action is required, and we do anticipate bringing these rules forward for adoption at the April board meeting. Item B2 is notice of our required minimum distribution rules. And in mid-December, we were notified that the Secure Act 2.0 was going to be passing by the end of the year, and which it did. And it was signed by the president on December 29th. And within that Secure Act 2.0, there is a change to the required minimum distribution age that was effective January 1. So this went through pretty quickly. The amendments that we're presenting today change the required minimum distribution age from 72 to 73 for both, of course, PERS and OSGP. Of course, this was not the only provision in the Secure Act 2.0. We are still evaluating the act to determine all of the provisions that affect PERS and OSGP. Many of those provisions are optional and have a much longer timeline for implementation. For most of them, I think we have until 2027. So you may see additional amendments to rules coming up over in the next couple of years if we need to make any other changes to the plan. It also raises, actually, the required minimum distribution age to age 75, but thankfully not until 2033. This is notice only, so no action is required, and we do anticipate bringing this forward at the April board meeting. And item B3 is adoption of our return to work rules. As a quick reminder, the amendments to these rules clarify when a period of disability ends, specifically for someone receiving workers' compensation payments. Specifically, that period ends the earlier of the last workers' compensation payment they receive or when they return to work. We received no public comment on this rule, and we made no changes to the rules since notice. So we're seeking a motion to adopt the rule as presented.
Any questions from the board?
This is Lawrence Fernstall. I move adoption of the return to work rules as presented.
Stephen Buckley, I second the motion.
Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye. Sadna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
Thank you, everyone. So moved.
Thank you. And finally, item B4 is adoption of our employer reporting rules. And as a quick reminder on this one, this is largely housekeeping. We are moving the rule from Division 70, which is specific to OPSERP, to Division 9, which is where all the rules for the employers reside. We also made some other little changes, such as removing a waiver or exemption that was put in place for calendar year 2011, which is obviously no longer applicable, so we removed that when we moved the rule. We received no public comment on this rule, and we made no changes to the rules since notice, so we are seeking a motion to adopt the rules as presented.
This is Lawrence Fernstall. I move adoption of the employer reporting rules as presented.
John Scanlon, I second.
Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye. Sadna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
Thank you all. So moved. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Next up is an update from Salem Heather case. I have to say, though, that on behalf of the board, that we are very, very disappointed that the ERM monies were denied us. But I know that everyone is working really hard to keep that thought out there. So hopefully next time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, my name is Heather Case, Senior Policy Advisor at PERS. Obviously, you have my memo regarding legislative updates. As always in the legislative session, things are ever changing. So I do want to highlight a couple of things that are out of date already on my memo. The first is in the agency legislation section. For the 2023 session, this isn't out of date, but I don't believe that last time I came before the board, we had bill numbers yet for our PERS agency bills. And now we do. So as you can see, that's House Bill 2283, 2284, and 2285. I know you all will be watching them very closely, just as we are. So I wanted to give you those numbers. We, of course, will be monitoring and advocating for the agency bills throughout the 2023 session, and we've already begun to do so. This session, our bills are being heard in front of the House Committee on Veterans, Emergency Management, and General Government. This is a little bit different. We all thought, including the chair of, I believe, the General Government Committee, that they would be heard in front of business and labor, which is usually where we are in both the Senate and the House. So we are getting to know the members of this committee, forming those relationships, and of course, advocating for our agency bills there.
Quick question. Do we know why this change? Why?
Chair Shenoy, I believe that the Business and Labor Committee had quite a large number of bills that they were hearing across so many different subjects. So I do believe that, so the committee, the General Government Committee, used to just be Veterans and Emergency Management. And so the General Government subject was added to this committee. And I believe that was to take some of the weight, I think, off of labor and business for the amount of bills they have to hear. At the time of the writing of this memo, the legislative session had about 2,000 bills. That number is climbing steadily towards 3,000. I think we're almost at 2,500 at this point. I fully anticipate that we'll get close to 3,000 in terms of bills introduced. Bills are still being introduced throughout the session, usually twice a week in first readings on the Senate and House floor. But the session is rolling along. Committee meetings are being held to a strict timeline because There are fewer hearing rooms available at the Capitol because it's undergoing seismic updates. So often if you'll be watching electronically for hearings, you'll hear construction noise and things like that. But the committees cannot go over time because there's so many groups that they have to fit in each room. So that is something that we do believe will limit the number of bills that each committee can hear and therefore potentially the number of bills that will pass. So that's something to kind of keep in mind throughout the session because 2,500 bills is quite a lot to get through. We do have some reporting requirements, as you can note in the memo, for the 2023 legislative session, including Senate Bill 1566, which you'll hear about today, and the preliminary earnings crediting, which you will all hear about today. We also, of course, will have to notify the legislature before the board adoption of actuarial methods and assumptions. That'll happen a little bit later. And then, of course, something to note, there are no longer direct reporting requirements to the legislature regarding Senate Bill 1049. We are, of course, continuing to involve our external partners and stakeholders in keeping them updated on Senate Bill 1049. Something that's brand new, breaking news, the agency will have its budget hearings on House Bill 5033, which is our PERS budget bill, another good number to keep note of. Those hearings will be on February 20th, 21st, and 22nd. On the 22nd, the agency will also present the Senate Bill 1566 report and the preliminary earnings crediting report. And we will also send those out probably right after the board meeting today as well, after the board's had a chance to hear them. So that is my brief report. I'm open to questions, obviously.
Heather, this is Stephen Buckley. Is there any information you can provide on House Bill 2601, which places some guardrails on what are acceptable and unacceptable investments by the Oregon Investment Council? And perhaps as that moves through the legislature, you might include it in your report to the board in future meetings. It doesn't directly affect the board, but we are keenly concerned about the investments by the Oregon Investment Council.
Absolutely. Chair Shenoy, Member Buckley, that is 2601 is absolutely on our radar, and I have made a note to include that in future reports to the board. In terms of progress on that bill or reporting kind of on the status, I have, Kevin and I both have connected with our respective colleagues in the state treasury who are of course, kind of spearheading the reports on this bill as well as effects and monitoring. So we are keeping in contact, particularly in regard to the fiscal impact of this bill, both obviously on OPERF, but then if there is an impact on OPERF, there is a subsequent impact to the PERS plan in general. So as you noted, our interests are very intertwined for this bill. So Kevin has also been invited to present a very brief overview on PERS at the hearing on House Bill 2601. On, I believe that is February 9th. Yes, February 9th. So he will be going down. Treasurer Reed did ask him to go down and provide that PERS overview to legislators as well. So we remain very involved in that bill and will continue to do so. I will typically in this first update of the legislative session, I don't like to drop bill numbers except for our bills, just because we never know what things are moving and not moving. But of course, in subsequent reports, more specific bills will be highlighted, including House Bill 2601. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, we move on to item C2, the Modernization Program Update by Rebecca Craven. First off, welcome to PERS.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, my name is Rebecca Jensen Craven, and I am the PERS Modernization Program Director, a position I've been delighted to hold for exactly 4 months. So I'm here to introduce myself, provide a brief update on current modernization program activities, and answer any questions you may have for me on our current work in progress. Just to tell you a little bit about myself, I came from within state government, most recently from Business Oregon, where I was a literal Jill of all trades of sorts in IT, working on modernization, data governance, geospatial data, broadband, and privacy initiatives. So, and before that, I was at Enterprise Information Services as an IT oversight analyst, where I got to work with FIRST, as well as an IT portfolio manager. And then also related to this a little bit, I also study technology policy as a doctoral candidate at Portland State University. And I get to teach fun classes like politics of cyberspace and managing information technology resources in my spare time about once a year. But that's enough about me. As has been explained in previous board meetings by Director Olenek and Deputy Director Elledge Rhodes, the PERS Modernization Program is a multi-biennial effort that aims to transform the ways that PERS connects with stakeholders by addressing the people, processes, and technologies at the heart of agency activities and initiatives. The goal of the program, the goals of the program reflect the agency's desire to not just make updates to these areas, but to really institute a culture of continuous improvement that ensures we have the processes to regularly evaluate and implement incremental change, rather than trying to do it all at once through these once every three decade massive system replacement or implementation projects. Continuous improvement will make us better able to keep up with the times and expectations of our members, employers, and other key stakeholders. But before we fully have a functioning culture of continuous improvement, we have to make foundational updates to our technologies and the processes that we use that will support this shift in our ways of working and ensure that our staff continues to have the knowledge, training, and support to conduct agency business in this way. While we are in the middle of many initiation tasks and activities for the program, as I noted in my memo to the board, I wanted to provide a few additional specifics on some items that were included. First, Director Olenek alluded to this, but I'm pleased to report that Governor Kochek included the entirety of our budget request in the governor's recommended budget released earlier this week. That request is for just under $9.6 million. It includes funding for several things, continuation of program-level planning and administration, that's under my purview, initiation and very early planning efforts for our first major project, which is the Client Relationship Management System, or CRM. It also includes implementation dollars for our first smaller project, which is our telephony upgrade project to evaluate our telephony needs and replace our aging phone system. And the request includes 16 positions, 10 of which will be within my new section of the agency and my hierarchy. These positions include a program manager, product owners, and associate product owners. And then there will be other positions, the other six, that will be part of other current PERS teams and matrixed into the program team structure. These will provide human resources, communications, procurement services, those kinds of things. While there's still quite a bit of work to do to support this request through the legislative budgeting process, we're enthused by the inclusion of the full request in the governor's recommended budget. We've also achieved a couple of important milestones in the past 6 weeks or so, including the finalization of our program charter and the establishment of the program steering committee, which has not only met, but made its first official decision as a steering committee. So that was a very exciting moment for us. We're in current program planning activities that are that include focusing on the program's governance plan, documenting the program's detailed scope, and specifying the measurable benefits that we intend for the program to deliver. We're also working on our on documenting our program management framework and our enterprise architecture framework so that the program resources, oversight bodies that we'll be interacting with, and program stakeholders know how the program will proceed through soon-to-become routine tasks and activities, as well as what those tasks and activities are as we continue working on the program. Essentially, a complex program like this with a long projected time span doesn't allow us to be as certain about every component for the entire duration right now in these early stages as we would be for a relatively straightforward IT implementation project. So instead, we're working on creating and publishing these robust and rigorous analysis and decision-making processes so that if we can't tell you exactly what 2031 is going to look like, we can at least tell you how we're going to make the decisions once we get closer. We're determining the review triggers and cadences for all the documentation I've mentioned as well. Again, showing the program's commitment to modeling the continuous improvement mindset that we're looking to implement here at PERS. And last but certainly not least, we are working with our external oversight partners to understand expectations for the program's processes and inputs as well as the oversight requirements that we'll need to meet as the program and its component projects get underway. The modernization program will be on at least an every other board meeting report out schedule. So at the very least, you can expect to see me again in June. As we get closer to the end of the legislative session and better understand the likely outcome of our budgeting request, we'll have more detail to present on what our activities for 23-25 look like as well. We'll have more finalized documents and resulting program plans and decisions from our ongoing activities this biennium to report on then too. And in the meantime, we're working to establish our formal monthly status reporting for the program that will include health of scope, schedule, budget, and the overall program. The January status report will be available sometime in February, and we can make that available to the board. It may take a little bit longer than usual to get that one out since it's our first one and we're still setting up the template, but we hope to have that available as soon as possible and then establish a regular monthly reporting cadence after that. And then as a final note, before making myself available to any questions you might have, through the other positions that I've had at the state, I've been exposed to many, many agencies, their cultures, leadership styles, and structures. And I had a very short list of agencies I was hoping to work for in the future. HERS is on that list, and I'm happy to report that the agency is living up to my previous observations. So I appreciate the time, and thank you. And with that, I'll gladly take any questions or comments you might have.
Welcome to PERS, Lawrence Fernstall here. You know, it's very exciting to hear that this is not just an IT project, but really a process and an ongoing methodology, if you will, for doing our work. Curious, what keeps you up at night now, 4 months in?
Chair Fenoy, Vice Chair Fernstall, thank you for the question. A lot of things.
Yeah.
mostly the amount of work that we have to do. It's a lot, and for the last 4 months, I've been a mighty section of one. I am very quickly looking to expand my team to help establish our patterns and processes for some of that work. So I think just the amount of work there is to do, but not as much as I thought there would have been. I'm very much looking forward to creating a process by which we can do some future state visioning, both within the agency and then outside of the agency as well with our members, employers, and other stakeholders, and really get into more of the dreaming of the possible rather than the nightmares of the system failure.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, welcome to PERS, John Scanlon here. I wonder if you could kind of speak to the challenges of the idea of the continuous improvement, maybe related to technology. And I heard you say that we have some sort of antiquated systems. So I guess in my mind, when I've seen these kind of things, they're more quantum leaps than a steady process because of the technology. We get new technology or whatever. So I would be interested in hearing your thoughts on that.
Chair Chenoy, Board Member Scanlon, thanks for the question. Yes, there are some quantum leaps that we do need to make, although we're hoping to do those in a very well-considered and drawn-out timeline, so it's not everything all at once. Our goal is to really focus on the people side of modernization as well to ensure that, you know, as we establish a continuous improvement process, we're making sure that people are not suffering from change fatigue and feel like they have the resources and are empowered to, you know, make their way through this change and also contribute to changes as time goes on. So we're really hoping to focus on the organizational change management side of this and ensure that we are preparing people. From a technology perspective, honestly, this is actually not one of the agencies that I've seen that has as much aged technology as some of the others that I've worked with. So we're well set up for starting a modernization process because we've already taken some critical steps like working on our data center and starting with that sort of infrastructural foundation work that our information services division has already been working on. So we have an opportunity, I think, to really demonstrate how some of this sort of long-term thoughtful planning can contribute to ensuring that we're not suffering from change fatigue at the end of this and are ready to really continue working to address our systems and evaluate on a regular basis how we can improve.
Well, Oregon PERS is a very complex system, and hopefully part of the weight of all this will be borne by the modernization program. So once again, welcome, and I'm glad you think it's a good fit because we appreciate your talents.
Chair Shinoy, thank you, and I'm happy to be here.
I want to apologize for the throat thing. It's not COVID, but the good news is that spring is in the air because these are definitely allergies. Jake Winship, Senate Bill 1566 reporting.
Good morning, Chair Shinoy, members of the board. For the record, my name is Jake Winship, and I am actuarial manager at PERS. And today I am reporting on the requirements, of Senate Bill 1566, and it essentially covers a number of separate programs. The first of those is the School District Unfunded Liability Fund. We also have the Employer Incentive Fund. We have the various unfunded actuarial liability, RF, resolution programs. And as part of that, I'll give an update on some of the changes we've made to the employer rate projection tool. So to start off with, I have the memo here, so I'll just try to hit some highlights rather than just reading through. One of the key points, we do have four revenue sources for the school district unfunded liability fund, and the idea is to provide relief to school districts in general. And basically the four forcing funding sources are interest on unclaimed property, we have a transfer of estate taxes, we have proceeds from capital gains taxes if they meet certain requirements, and then finally we have debt collection. Those last two have had relatively little activity, and we do not anticipate, based on the Oregon Economic Advisors reports, to have any in the 2023 calendar year. We did receive a substantial transfer in 2022, and that was approximately, that was in the amount of $45 million. So we've had a substantial increase in the balance of this fund. Last year, this time, it was under $500,000. Now it's nearly $50 million. However, in order to have a substantial rate relief because of the amortization factors of side account and just the sheer size of payroll for the school district, we estimate that a 1% decrease would require a fund transfer of approximately $580 million. So not that $50 million is nothing, but it's much less than $580 million. And so we also had an update to the forecast for the estate taxes last year. That is anticipated to be transferred in 2023. Last year it was approximately $67 million. Now it's about $89 million. So we'll see if that materializes, but that is based on the most recent OEA document. We will not have any interest on unclaimed funds. As you'll hear later, there was actually a loss on many of the state funds. So rather than charging us, they'll just have no transfer for the next year, and that's based on fiscal 2022. And at this point, does anyone have questions about the SDULF? Very good. Then I will give an update on the Employer Incentive Fund. That is going very well. We continue to have strong interest in that. We're closing out our initial phase. And because of some budget requirements previously, we had a wait list of employers that had applied and been approved to get match dollars. And unfortunately, we had a reduction in the amount available. Last year, the legislature restored funding, and they actually moved that from, rather than lottery proceeds, from the general fund. So that was specifically to satisfy all of the previously approved employers that had matches. We have now fully exhausted that general fund. So everything forward is coming from the lottery funds. We continue to have quarterly transfers. We do have the final deadline for matching will be March 31st of this year. And we are currently working on communication for all remaining employers, reminding them of the deadline and their approved amounts, and really inviting them to apply. Any funds that are not claimed by that date will remain in the employer incentive fund. We hope to accumulate that over time. Our current planning is that when that balance reaches approximately $25 million, we will open a new phase of application. And we currently anticipate that would be sometime in 2025. In terms of the unfunded actuarial liability resolution program, we have a number of measures with that. One of the key tools we developed is what we call the employer rate projection tool. We've actually updated that with factors from the 2021 actuarial valuation. So that has been put into production near the end of January. So that's in place. We also have established a procedure. We have some user interface fixes. Essentially, we have some misleading labels, but we do have a plan and a project to have those corrected. And we're also implementing a recurring process in order to not only provide data updates, which would generally happen in the December to January timeframe, but we would also in the June and July timeframe, we would actually have functional enhancements and reflect a lot of the features that employers have requested. And we hope that the timing of that will be particularly helpful to them as they enter a new biennium or at least a new fiscal year. Then finally, we have a number of guides. They're listed here. We found them to be very helpful, and it's a way that we can codify knowledge. When people come to questions, we can direct them to these items. It provides a good high-level introduction to a lot of the concepts. And then we have found that the subsequent questions are a little more focused, so we can reference that and have a better context. So that has been successful. We are currently working on another guide. It's Guide to Understanding Pension Obligation Bonds. There's been a lot of interest, a lot of additional reporting with the Oregon State Treasury Debt Management Committee. So they have some additional requirements that employers need to satisfy. So we've added some support for that as well. We hope that this document will answer a lot of the questions they have and increase general understanding. And I'm happy to answer any questions that the board has.
If I could ask the board to acknowledge receipt of this, that would be great. Thanks.
Do we need a motion?
Yeah. Thank you.
This is Lawrence Fernstall. First of all, thank you for providing all of these tools as a as a PERS employer manager. They're very helpful, and the continual improvement of it is very much appreciated, certainly from our perspective. I move that the board recognize receipt of and acceptance of this report.
John Scanlon, I second.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye. Sadna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Yardon Jaramillo, aye.
Thank you. Also moved. Thank you again.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, members of the board.
The next item is the preliminary 2022 earnings crediting. Matt Graves, Richard Horsford.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, I'm Richard Horsford, Chief Financial Officer with Oregon PERS. I am continuing to fight a sickness that's made my voice unreliable. So I'm going to pass the baton to Mr. Graves and remain available should I be able to provide any additional insight.
Okay.
Thank you, Richard. Good morning, Chair Shinoy, members of the board. For the record, Matt Graves, financial reporting manager. And today I'm here to present for you the preliminary earnings crediting and reserves for 2022 with the end goal of being to ask the board to pass a motion to adopt the preliminary crediting of earnings presented for calendar year 2022. I'd like to direct your attention to page 4 of the earnings memo, which is actually page 95 of your packet. And here you will find a table that presents a summary of the earnings crediting allocations, most of which are non-discretionary and or directed by applicable statutes or administrative rules. There's a few things I would like to highlight in here. The table does show the effect of investment expenses and administrative expenses on crediting and some other adjustments that include mid-year retirements and administrative expenses paid for out of employer contributions. I'll get to that a little bit later. As you can see here, the reserves prior to crediting were about $96.9 million. That's the far left column. And then end up at $94.7 billion after crediting. And then Tier 1 member, regular member accounts and judge accounts will be credited the assumed rate of 6.9%. Because earnings for 2022 are negative, the Tier 1 rate guarantee reserve absorbs those losses and covers the mandatory crediting up to the assumed rate. So what you'll see here is that the Tier 1 rate guarantee reserve is reduced by $219 million to cover the assumed rate plus the investment losses. In the previous year, for context, when earnings were more than 20%, the Tier 1 rate guarantee reserve had an actual increase of $451 million. So balances out. You can see there over on the far right with the rates as we go down for Tier 2, minus 1.89%, same with benefits in force, Tier 1 and Tier 2 employees pension stability accounts, also minus 1.89, and then the OPSER pension and EPSA are minus 1.88. I will highlight for you the employer reserves rate is minus 1.98. It's a little bit more losses there. That is because administrative expenses are funded by employer contributions when earnings are not sufficient to cover those costs. The variable annuity accounts, they're not in this table here, but they're up in the memo. The preliminary rate is estimated at negative 24%, which actually shows that OIC, you know, how well OIC did in comparison with a more diversified portfolio compared to the variables just invested in equities. There's another chart, actually, a couple pages before this that summarized the IAP earnings by TDF. So if you want to look at the target date funds individually, those are there. And then on the third page, there is another summary with the health insurance accounts. Those are listed for RIA, RIPA, and the standard retiree health insurance account. The SRIA is invested in the short-term fund. RIA and RIPA are a little bit different from the other rates because of administrative expenses, and they have smaller balances, so those impact the rates a little bit more. One more thing to point out. In 2016, the board approved contingency reserve transfers of $21.9 million to fund the OPSERP IAP first wage cleanup project. In December 2021, about $18 million was transferred to cover the costs of that project. The board replenished the contingency reserve back to $50 million in March of 2022 out of earnings crediting. Staff then discovered an additional $19,000 that needed to be transferred from contingency reserve to cover additional costs related to this project after the board meeting. So that was the approval was up to $22 million. So that was done. We are not asking the board to replenish the contingency reserve today because they're not earnings sufficient to do so. So we would do that in a future year. Because that amount is so small, $19,000, it doesn't show up in this table due to rounding. So with that, are there any questions of me?
Mr. Graves, this is Steve Buckley. Could you explain, provide a little bit more information on what the purpose or the function of the benefits in force reserve is?
Sure. Yeah. Chair Shinoy, Board Member Buckley, thank you for the question. The benefits in force reserve is intended to
fund all future pension benefits. So it is funded at the time of a member's retirement. There's a calculation done using equivalency tables and assumed rate, and employer reserves or member accounts are charged for the present value of future pension benefits for that member, for that retiree. And then from that transfer, the earnings accumulate to eventually pay those benefits out. And it's only for Tier 1 and Tier 2. Officer has its own fund. You're welcome.
So I had a good question, and I think we decided that it was a typo from last year, but I'm looking at the Tier 1 rate guarantee reserve.
Yes.
And the agenda from exactly 1 year ago stated that that fund ended at $450 million after additions for that year. And so all of these numbers don't jive, so I was wondering if you can help.
Right. Yeah, thank you, Chair Shinoy. The $450 million last year was actually the increase in that reserve from the earnings. So what you see in the table on the fourth page, on page 95 of the packet, is the correct beginning balance of that reserve, and then you'll see the adjustments over to the right. So the ending balance there of $742 million is correct.
So 450 was the increase
was
in
the increase
2021.
In 2021, correct. Right.
Okay. Any other questions? We need a motion to approve.
Yeah. John Scanlon, I would like to move that we adopt the preliminary crediting of earnings as presented for calendar year 2022, subject to final adoption at the April 3rd, 2023 PERS board meeting.
Lawrence Fernstall seconds.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye. Sadhana Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
Thank you all. So moved.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful.
Chair Shinoy, this is just a reminder. I know I mentioned to you and Director Oldenick that I'll be stepping out of the meeting and returning at 11, but just wanted to let you know since I'm off camera. Thank you.
We tried our best to wrap up the meeting by 10, but, just a few minutes short. So thank you.
What a gift. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Good morning, members of the board, Chair Shinoy. I am Matt Larrabee with the Portland office of Milliman. I'm joined by Scott Preppernot, and we'll be speaking to action and discussion item 5, the Milliman response to the Secretary of State's actuarial review that was presented at the last PERS board meeting. A formal response is included in the board packet. So I'll keep my remarks relatively brief by my standards, and then we, of course, would be happy to take questions on this item. To not lose the headline in terms of the review, first and foremost, the most important thing with the actuarial review that was conducted by the outside firm was that the work was found to be technically correct, in compliance with relevant professional standards, and actuarially sound. The review had praise for the rate collaring methodology that we use to set employer contribution rates. I'd also just want to note for the record, I don't think this was really covered in our letter, that I do think that the way that the review was conducted made it a robust review with aligned incentives. An outside agency, Secretary of State's office, which is charged with matters, brought in the firm. The firm's incentives would actually be, they'd be better served if they found items and they found nits to pick and things like that. So the fact that none of that really happened is heartening to Scott, to myself, to the rest of the team. We note in the letter that we appreciate the review that was conducted. We have high regard for the folks that conducted the review. We know them professionally and have respect for their work. And also want to note to the board and for the record that Scott and I take each and every suggestion that they make seriously. And to that end, we have the formal response written form as promised. In that formal response, we address each and every suggestion, recommendation that they have in there. And I would broadly put those into three categories. there are some items that between now and when we start to conduct the experience and method review study, which we do every 2 years, Scott and I and our team will work with Jake in his role as actuarial manager and the rest of PERS staff to kind of talk through some of those flagged items and figure out which ones are appropriate to bring to the board for further discussion and consideration. There are other items that we have noted that we will just simply incorporate into our report without discussion or bringing it back to the PERS board. These tend to be things around additional written disclosures. Let's make the actuarial reports longer. We're always in favor of making the actuarial reports longer. And then I'd say that the third category is kind of more of the duly noted, that these are things that that they noted that we spoke to in the written response, but we really don't intend to bring to staff or the board for further discussion or necessarily modify our methodology. And in a little bit of an informal sense, I have a phrase that I like to use over time, which is that when nerds fight, everyone loses. And all of you and the other stakeholders would be collateral damage. These are the sorts of items where it's like, okay, even the actuaries find these items that were raised pedantic. They wouldn't change the accuracy of the results. They would just simply change the precision and add to the complexity. And where that was the case, we try to explain that in the audit letter, and we will leave it at that. So I think that's my relatively brief summary. There will be probably an item or two. I think the issue of the time lag and how to handle that is something that we'll bring back for consideration. It was a very intentional decision on our part when we 86 that 10 or 15, 20 years ago, whenever it was. But it is one that we'll bring back with the board for additional discussion. And then the only thing I'd add on the time lag was that in the audit report that went to the Secretary of State, there was a bit of a flag that said, oh, you should incorporate this. The relevant professional standard says that you should consider. And these standards are developed very carefully. The amount of wordsmithing that goes on there is absurd. And there is a gulf between should consider and shall. Yeah. And the time lag is a should consider item. We have considered it in the past. We will consider it in the future. And that will probably be the one item from this review that you will be subject to additional torturous discussion at subsequent meetings.
Now, this is Steve Buckley. Is the issue concerning the contribution time lag ultimately a board decision or an actuary decision?
Great question, Board Member Buckley. I would say that it is ultimately a board decision because it relates to funding calculation methodology, but it is on the advice of the actuary. So, we would be the ones that explain it. We provide policy alternatives, and then ultimately the board decides. And I will say that the way we viewed that in the past is, and I use that expression, accuracy versus precision. The time lag adds additional precision, but it also adds additional complexity while not, in our view, changing the overall accuracy of the report. And so there was a very conscious decision when Scott and I and other members of the team at our prior firm took over the work to remove that methodology because we felt like the cost benefit wasn't right there in terms of the understandability to employers and to other key stakeholders.
Well, we are really happy that the nerds do battle because I consider myself fairly good financially, but the actual sometimes those techniques are way above my head. So I'm really glad you have someone that looks at what you are doing, and we are, of course, delighted that there were no serious concerns in the review.
Thank you, and I appreciate it. And I think the Secretary of State's office did a good job of picking out kind of very well-regarded professionals nationally to do the work. And we as a firm, Milliman, are greatly appreciative of it because, as you all know, how complex Oregon PERS is, and that complexity really expresses itself in the liability calculations, the rate calculations. So it's really not just a best practice, but close to imperative to have an independent, critical, experienced set of eyes kind of kicking the tires and looking under the hood of the car.
And I'm sure we'll address this again at a future meeting, but I thought that your comments on this contribution lag adjustment recommendation, you've addressed it thoroughly and you've seen it from everybody's point of view. So I felt comfortable that that this was going to be okay. But I'm sure we'll come back to it in July.
Okay.
And just as a note, we will be forwarding this copy of this letter to the Secretary of State, too, so they have it on file.
Any other questions? No? So we can move on. Thank you so much for this.
All right. Last item then from us is just a brief update. Now that I've closed the books on 2022, we can actually look back and where in December we were doing a bunch of forward-looking financial modeling and projections on funded status and contribution rates. We can take a very narrow look and say, now that we're actually past the end of the year and we know that OPERF returned -1% to -2%.
Yeah.
Where would that kind of put our starting point relative to what we were talking about at the start of December? So as just a high-level estimate, and again, this is going to be before any gains or losses that come through in this year's valuation for salary changes, mortality experience, stuff like that, and before any assumptions that might change as part of the experience study. But we would estimate that given where the OPERF returns ended up for 2022, funded status at the end of the year would be about 74% to 75% without including side accounts. That maps to a UAL of $25 to $26 billion. And including the side accounts, it would be more like 80% funded and about a $20 billion UAL. So relative to the last rate setting valuation at the end of 2021, those funded status numbers are down 5% to 6% given the returns of the year. It is a little bit better picture than sort of the starting point at our December financial modeling. At that point, we were reflecting returns through September of last year, and the fund was down 4% or so at that point. So, if you were to try to recalibrate from the financial modeling, we're slightly above the median that we probably were starting from there. But, we'll have more final numbers that obviously reflect this, these returns, but also demographic experience, any assumption changes and stuff when we get to the valuation this year. And as a reminder, this is not a rate setting valuation date. So it's kind of the, interim waypoint between this and the next one. Okay. Any questions?
Okay. Good.
Right. Thank you.
You don't even have a slide, if you know.
Thank you all very much. Any other questions, comments, board members? So that pretty much brings us to the end of our agenda. Thank you to everyone for participating in this meeting. Happy almost spring to everybody. And we will see you April 3rd. Good. This meeting is adjourned.